Darling one, you were born from the sweetest love, cast from the fires of creation, burning bright into the making of your perfect constellations. Head high, my love, never let them diminish you. Stand tall in the power of your love. Break open to the thousands come before you, written in your heart with holy blood. Keep going, my love. Hold tight to the scripture of your inheritance, your dreams born from ancient stone. Weave your magic, star of wisdom, breathing life into hollow bones. Courage, my love. Place pain upon your sacred altars. Grow seeds where life has become hopeless. Lend hands to those who fall and falter. Let love be life's greatest opus. Welcome, beautiful souls. My name is Tara Brading, and I am the creator of the Dreaming the Ancestors podcast series, where we talk about remembering and reclaiming ancestral stories, feminine wisdom, and earth magic. This is the 11th episode, and I'm very, very excited to welcome Carolyn Hillier to the podcast today. Carolyn is a renowned artist, musician, writer, drum maker, and workshop teacher of 30 years standing, who lives and works on an ancient farmstead amid the wild hills of Dartmoor, southwest England. She sings of ancient spirit and hidden memory, and has released over 20 music albums, solo projects, and collaborations. She writes about ancestral roots and the deep experience of women in their weaving of courageous life paths. Her books include Weaver's Oracle, Her Bone Bundle, Book of Hag, Wild Litany, and Sacred House. She paints life-size images of archetypal and mythological women, which are exhibited as large shrine installations. Three decades of these paintings form the bones of her Weaver's Oracle. For many years, she has created traditional skin drums using deer, wild horse, reindeer, and salmon. In 2020, a collection of her drums were exhibited at a museum in Arctic Sweden. Carolyn has been guiding women's workshops for 30 years internationally and within the UK, especially on Dartmoor, and she's created an online teaching program called The Weaver's Trail, which is shared by women all over the world. The ceremonial Neolithic-style roundhouse built at her farm is the focal point for her work around the deep ancestry of the British Isles. For many years, she's been exploring the hidden depths of the Bronze Age bone language known as Proto-Celtic, which she has creatively reimagined in her book, Her Bone Bundle. I am so, so honored to bring Carolyn onto the podcast. This has been a long time coming, and there's so much that I resonate with in Carolyn's work. So welcome, Carolyn. Thank you for being here, and happy for you just to come on and say a quick hello to everyone and introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much, Tara, for inviting me to be part of the podcast. And I'm really looking forward to sharing some things with you this evening. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And as always on this podcast, I want to begin our conversation by imagining that we are having this conversation heart to heart, and that all of you who are listening are in circle with Carolyn and I, and we are sitting around this great fire, really honoring the spirit of the fire. So I invite us to close our eyes, feeling ourselves gathered around the fire of humanity, the fire of the ancestors. Our ancestors shared stories around the fire for generation through generation, going all the way back to the very first humans. So I'd like to take a moment for Carolyn and I to invite in and honor our ancestors. I would like to honor and welcome in my wise grandmothers. I'd like to welcome in my sacred grandmother guide of the hearth, Naibo Nani. I feel her tending the fire that is in the center of our circle, helping us to remember the ancient ways of our ancestors. I'd also like to honor the wise grandfathers and the grandfather guide of my lineage, who I call Naibawiru, really feeling the energy of the sacred masculine and the protectors of my lineage standing around us. You are also here to be part of this remembering. Naibonani, Naibawiru, Askerno Kacho, Biwo Kacho, I welcome you.
And I'd like to offer a blessing in Proto-Celtic and in English, using actually some of the words that Tara's just used in her blessing. Galweo Noibonani, we call you sacred grandmothers. Galweo Noibowiro, we call you sacred grandfathers. Galweo Karetsa Mewe, we call you kinspeople of ours. Sirashto, Sirashto. Sirashto Galweo, we are yearning, 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 so we call you. Noibo Nani Wiro Mewe Galweo, we call you our sacred grandmothers, grandfathers, we call you. Galweo Noibo Nani, Galweo Karetsa Mewe, Sirashto, Sirashto. Sirashto Galweo, Noibonani Mewe, Galweo.
Honoring all of the ancestors who are stepping in to be here with us. There's such a deep remembering in me every time I hear you sing and pray in Proto-Celtic. And the title of this episode is inspired by that deep resonance, that deep remembering. So this episode is called Reviving the Proto-Celtic Language and the Ancient Ways of Woman. I've been so deeply moved by reading Carolyn's book, Her Bone Bundle, in which she revives and reimagines the Proto-Celtic language, which is a language spoken by ancient ancestors across various parts of Europe, including the British Isles. And as a woman of English ancestry, this is very meaningful to me, since we don't have an ancient mother tongue like the Celtic nations that surround England. So Carolyn's work has awakened in me and many others a sense of what our indigenous tongue might have been before the Anglo-Saxons came. And there is, as I shared, this bone-deep ancestral remembering that happens in the presence of this language, in the speaking and singing and listening of it, that is difficult to put into words. And hopefully those of you listening got a small experience of that during the Proto-Celtic prayer song that Carolyn just offered a few moments ago. Carolyn, your dedication to the revival of this language is truly inspiring, and though this is the primary reason I've invited you to the podcast today, I know that you have so much deep wisdom to share about the ancestors and the ancient ways of women. So I'd love to begin by just hearing a little bit about your journey and how you became interested in Proto-Celtic and the ancient ancestors.
Thank you, Tara. So I came out of my young womanhood engaged in feminist activism, and in my early 20s, I began to encounter the spirit of the land, the spirit of nature, and was exploring with other women in my community and discovering for the first time ancient prayers in the land with the moon, with the stones, with the shrines that we were creating in the wild. I began to find a vehicle for expressing this, which for me was initially through painting and then through song and writing, and gradually strengthening the threads of this, but always rooting the experience of it into the sacred and ancient landscape. And Dartmoor, where I live now, became important to me in my young womanhood, but it was my early 30s before I finally got my feet back into this land and managed to root myself here and actually to anchor all my work into this landscape and draw the inspirational food into my work from the land. And Dartmoor's an extraordinary place, even within the British Isles, because it has a greatest concentration of ancestral dwellings and ritual circles and stone rows, burial chambers, and most of it is undisturbed because the high parts of the moor aren't inhabited. So these ancient places have remained as they were in their bone form. So reaching down into that Bronze Age and Neolithic ancestry has been what has anchored and deepened and strengthened my work over the last 30 years. And it's gone further in that respect. I wanted to go deeper into the memory of the land, into the primordial memory of the land. So I began 20 years ago to travel to the far north, to the Arctic in Sweden and Siberia. Done those journeys for a long time now. And they were primarily as a way of being able to reach into an ancestral ice route in the landscape where I live. And so then I was looking for a language, a way of being able to describe all of this. And I stumbled really across Proto-Celtic. I'd been searching, I'd been yearning, but I didn't really know how to find a trail towards it. So it came as a surprise. I just found it one day. And my encounter with it, to start with, was like plunging into a cold river. It was rushing through my veins and spinning me around. I was captivated by what felt like the strangeness of it, but also the deep, profound familiarity with it. And my seeking for all this time for an indigenously ancient voice with which to sing the primordial mythology of the landscape, I at last found it in these words, in these Proto-Celtic words. And so I began to delve and explore and deepen and look for this wealth, this hidden treasure, which had been so forgotten.
Deeply honoring your deep listening of the land and your deep connection to the land. Yeah, I really resonate with what you shared about wanting to pray with the land and have a language, an ancient voice to be in connection with the land. And that is very much something that I feel come through in the Proto-Celtic language, as you shared. So I'd love to hear about the process of reviving Proto-Celtic from the scholarly aspect of this to the deeply spiritual.
Yes, well, I started by finding an online academic lexicon in a university in Wales. It was just a word list, thousands of words, and actually no one had been working with it since 2011. And when I communicated with the university, no one responded. It wasn't a current project. Everyone had just left it. So I began looking elsewhere. I found very few sources. I found a very old source in the Czech Republic. It was a photocopied pages from a book that had been written by someone who had studied Proto-Celtic there, because it did come originally from Central Europe and then moved up through the north and west of Europe to reach these islands about 4,000 years ago, but it was rooted further down into the European mainland. So gradually I got pieces together, but everything was very dry, very academic. It felt it had been linguistically squeezed into a shape. It was very masculinized, all the translations, very Christianized. And it felt like the whole language needed to have a chance to breathe. So I resolved very early on that I wasn't going to approach it with my head, but with my soul, and find a way of re-energizing and reawakening it. So I stepped into this role that I gave myself, really, of curating the language as if it was a pile of bones, choosing, laying out these beautiful bone words and moving them around and trying to get a sense of what was underneath all of this dust of, you know, the academic years and all the studies and this time that it had been left and abandoned, really. And it's a bone language because it's not in contemporary use. It's the mother tongue of all the Celtic languages, all the different branches of the living Celtic languages. And the way that Proto-Celtic has been gathered up is by looking at all of those contemporary languages and finding the words which are the same. So they're the oldest words, and putting them, as it were, into a basket, then stepping back into a previous generation of language. And this is the mother tongue of the Celtic languages, this Proto-Celtic from our Bronze Age people. So I wanted to find this untamed song voice, not only of Dartmoor, where I live, but a language that's infused with stone and fire and rivers and the spirit house and the bone bundle and wolf and old women and the wounds of winter. And so I worked over the whole of a winter with these words, and I symbolically had them around the fire in our ancestor house, and I gathered up each bone and burnished it by the light of the fire and began to get a sense of the meaning, dreaming into the meanings of these words and discarding the ones that felt they weren't serving us. So, for example, there were a lot of words, a lot, for warrior and war hero and blade and these kind of things. And we just didn't need so many of those. We needed to find the words that would feed and enhance and deepen our spiritual relationship with the land so that we would have something that we could carry out with us to meet nature, to meet the ancestors and be able to communicate. So I worked with them in this way. And then by the end of the winter, I had this beautiful, ordered, gleaming mounds of bones laid out across the floor, and it was ready to take it out and bring it into the form of this book. And I love the liberation of this, because this is a remembered, re-dreamed bone language. It belongs to any of us, anyone who feels that it fits their landscape or their dreamscape or the shape of their soul, or anyone who's looking for an ancient voice through which to connect with ancestral memory or sacred earth. And I love that we can shape it the way that it fits our own mouths, our own requirement for what we're wanting to express. So I've taught this in lots of different places, including the Czech Republic, where it was also an ancestral language. And the women there speak it with an entirely different way of expressing the words. They've taken the language, they've fitted it into their own mouths. And it's so beautiful to see the flexibility of that. There's nobody within this, the use of this language, that can say that you are doing it wrong. What matters most is that you feel the words and the integrity and intention of the words.
Beautiful to hear about the ways in which this language is being revived and remembered through use and practice and being in circle with women, and how the land wants to be in communication with us through the language. It's so powerful, so very powerful. And there's a freedom to it as well, because there isn't a right and wrong way. And so it's beautiful for devotions and prayers and whatever way the words want to come into form through our mouths, through our hearts.
I would like to share just a small piece that I've written from the Bone Bundle book, which is the most important thing that I could share about this language, because it's about why it's relevant to us now. Why is this ancestral language significant or even relevant to us in our now existing world? Because language is part of identity, and when we identify with something that fits our deep sense of ourselves and our place in this world, then we grow in strength and clarity, trust and confidence. Because this ancient mother tongue offers us a new way of describing our sacred relationship with the soul of our world, it presents us with an untamed channel of communication that is not hemmed in by contemporary cultural parameters or the accumulated burdens of history and politics that weigh down modern language. When we use ancient language to express our deepest, truest, most raw relationship with a wild place, a piece of the earth, then we begin to recognize and unravel our intangible yearning for home and to connect with our own indigeny. We feel that we belong. And when we know that we belong, we also know how to celebrate and honor the natural world of which we're a part, and we come to understand more profoundly our responsibilities towards it. And when we realize the truth and magnitude of those responsibilities, we know we must work together to meet them. And when we all meet our responsibilities as human people, indigenous to this earth, then we stand some chance of soothing and mending, healing and protecting what we as a species have broken. So I do seem to be suggesting that singing and praying in the proto-Celtic language can, in some small way, contribute to the vast global movement of hopeful and courageous human people who are committed and determined to preserve the precious integrity of life on this planet.
I get such a feeling in my body, Carolyn, when I hear you speak about the language, and I have, you know, engaged in my way with the language. And there is this deep connection between Indigenous language and the earth. And I actually heard once from the Kogi, who are an Indigenous tribe in South America, who I spent time with. And I heard them talking about this connection between Indigenous language and the earth. And they said that every time an Indigenous language is lost, an animal species dies. But it was something to that effect. And it speaks to the ways in which we are so interwoven with the earth in ways that are mysterious and spiritual, in ways that our modern minds fail to comprehend, because it's something that is has been forgotten by many of us in the modern world, and it's not something that lives in the mind. It lives in the heart and in the soul.
In response to what you were saying about the Kogi, the first time I ever taught this language to a group of women was about 5 years ago, and there was a group of Indigenous older women from all around the world, Native American from Canada, Aboriginal woman, Mexican, and a Kogi woman. And they were coming to this place in the southwest of England here. There were about 200-300 women gathered to receive them for this special visit. And I was asked to teach something for the women to sing as they arrived into the circle, as the elders came into the circle. And I thought, this was the moment where we could start really expressing our own indigene through this language, first time I ever taught it. So as we were waiting for the women to arrive, I taught all of these women a couple of songs in the Potawatomi and watched how they began to cry as they were singing, because the words were going in so profoundly into them, into their bodies, into their remembering. And then when the women arrived, the elder women, including the Kogi woman, arrived into the circle, for the first time, women on this land were singing to them in Potawatomi. And it was an amazing moment. And I felt it was a really beautiful opening for the first time of how we were being able to use our language in this way.
I have tears in my eyes hearing this, and this feeling that these languages of the earth connect us regardless of our culture, regardless of our race, regardless of our history. This goes deeper than all of those layers and really gets to the heart of our connection with the earth. And so what you just shared just moved me very deeply in that way. One of my favorite aspects of your book, Her Bone Bundle, is the wisdom you share about the eight ancestral women who came to sit with you by the hearth as you were sorting through their language. And so I'd love for you to share a little bit about these eight women, who they are, how they came to you, and how they supported your process of ancestral dreaming and remembering.
This is the Matijar, the mother line. And right from the beginning, I was looking for these sacred women hidden within the language, and some of them were easy to find. They arrived smoothly, and others I had to search really hard within the language to find them. But in the end, they were all asking to be remembered and to be reconnected to a raw pagan animistic root. So in this way, a word, for example, one of the eight women is Lagiano, who we translate as shrine keeper, prayer anchor, land guardian. But in the academic lexicon, she was translated as nun. So, you know, Christianized version of, so who is this woman? Who is, what is the nature of her spiritual role? So she became the shrine keeper. And then from that place, she's evolved. Her role has been evolving as women have gathered up this word Lagiano, and they've made it their own, and they have become the wild shrine keepers. And it's part of the work that I do in my online program with women, that she's one of the roles that women step into, Lagiano. But there's others. So Nurse was in there, and she gradually became clarified into midwife, into this wider context of a birthing companion, a protector of women. And then I was looking all the time for the words that we have so lacking in our language, and we borrow from Siberia, which is shaman woman. And, you know, we have many different ways we can express this. We maybe describe her as a witch, or we describe her in as a hearth woman, whatever these different versions. There was something else, there was a stronger word that I was needing to locate. And I finally found her, and she was buried underneath this context of a male wizard. And I pulled her out of that and really sat with this word for a long time. And we have her in the form that she's arrived. She means shaman woman, mystic, and spirit traveler. And she is this word, Svetla. Svetla. So she was a really important woman to discover within the language. I feel that the academic lexicons were being created in a very separate from the context of the domestic and tribal and spiritual cultures that were speaking this language. So it was, that's why everything was very dry and tightly confined. It was so important to find a way that these mystic, magical, and devout women could breathe and be touching the earth again and being witnessed by the ancestral spirits of the land. So we have eight of them. Nani, we've already mentioned her in our blessing. She's the grandmother, the wise elder. Wedje is the weaver of hearth magic and of memory and life. Svetla, I've already mentioned. Lifagi is a healer with plant medicines and also a healer with ritual. Then there's Lagyana, who is the nun who became the shrine keeper. Welet is the oracle voice, the myth teller, the truth sayer. And then Magsta, who is the midwife and birthing companion. And then at the end there, Rakayika. This is a beautiful phrase. And this is a woman who heals and mends and makes whole. So as these women emerged, and there are others, but these were the first ones who came along in the journey with the language. But we, you know, I'm finding others as we move through the depths of the words. But this was like finding eight pieces of treasure. Really, it's as if we have eight beads of smooth, well-worn amber that have been passed from hand to hand, from generation to generation, and they've reached us. And these eight ancient women can be beaded onto the necklace of our own unfurling journeys. So it has been a treasure, and certainly something that women have really anchored into very profoundly, taking on and developing and, you know, really working with these different roles.
What you've just shared is such a beautiful, shining example of dreaming with the ancestors, which is the name of this podcast, of course. And it's such a beautiful practice of truly listening to the ancestors in the way that they want to come to us and be heard and be felt and to share their wisdom with us. And so I get such a feeling from this remembering that came through you with the language and the ancestors and the women in particular who were buried beneath layers of patriarchy and modernity over time and have been revived and given another chance at speaking to us through the lineage in ways that are so powerful.
I have a small song about the remembering in Proto-Celtic. So it means this: we remember all that we have spun, all that we have woven, the path of needle to the cloth, the blanket and the braid. We remember the magic of our bundles, the magic of our circles, the magic of our songs, all our wisdom. We remember the blanket and the braid. We remember all our wisdom. Kamano ni sweti to ni sandewe snate jabreto sago and snijo sago and snijo. Kamano gren jo soy to samana soy to nata soy to quakowitsu quakowitsu.
Thank you so much for sharing with us. There is such a deep river of memory that it invites us to step into. I'd like to speak to another aspect of your book that really interests me, which was to do with your reflections on the Bronze Age woman who was found on Dartmoor in recent years. He's become known as White Horse Hill Woman. And so I'm just going to share a little bit about this ancient woman for those of you listening. So her cremated bones were carefully wrapped in fur, along with her most valuable possessions. And the fur might have been from a bear, from a species that became extinct in Britain at least 1,000 years ago. And this fur bundle was packed into a basket and carried up to one of the highest and most exposed spots on Dartmoor, where this woman was buried in a small stone box covered by a mound of peat. The bundle contained a lot of unique objects, including a tin bead and tin studs, and textiles, including a nettle fiber belt with a leather fringe, and also jewelry, including amber from the Baltic and shale from northern England. And there was also an armband and a wooden ear stud, and the armband was actually plated from cow hair, and originally it would have been studded with tin beads that would have shone like silver. And there were even charred scraps of textile that might have been the remains of a shroud and fragments of charcoal from a funeral pyre. So this woman, this ancient woman from the Bronze Age, was found recently. And Carolyn, I'd love for you to share a little bit about your experience of connecting with White Horse Hill Woman and the ceremony that you did for her.
This was a huge thing to have happened on Dartmoor. It was about 13, 14 years ago. And it was known that this Kistven, which is a granite, small granite tomb for cremated remains rather than for a whole body, so that's a Bronze Age style tomb. It was known that it was in this location, this very remote ridge right in the centre of the North Moor, which is probably a couple of two to three hours from where I live, up on the open moor there. And it was known that it was there, but the kist was becoming damaged by erosion and the animals rubbing against it. So it was decided to preserve what may or may not be inside. So an excavation happened, the first one in 100 years. No excavations happen of burial places anymore here on Dartmoor. It's considered important to just leave everything where it is. But because of the potential damage, it was decided to do this. And it was a friend of mine who was chief archaeologist of the Dartmoor National Park at that time, about to retire. And then this arrived, this possibility. And she wanted to midwife this being into the world. So she stayed on and supervised it. So we got a really beautiful recollections from her about how that process had been. When they first went to the kist to start to remove the top stone, they could see there was this red fur inside, reddish coloured fur. And initially they thought maybe somehow a fox had got inside and died there. They weren't really sure. But of course, when they took the capstone off, they realised they had an intact bone bundle. And of course, it was very squashed over time. It didn't look like anything magical. It was a squashed, very muddy, peaty. But as they lifted it, beads started to fall out. And this was a huge, amazing discovery, because up to then they only had about 8 or 10 beads from the Bronze Age that had been preserved from Dartmoor. When they opened up the bundle, they had another 200 beads on this amazing composite necklace. And of course, they began to investigate all the detail of what was inside the bundle. She was actually dispersed all around Northern Europe into different laboratories while they were doing this work and reconstructing and preserving. And during that time, we started to have conversations here on the moor, the women living locally here, the community here, that we needed to somehow hold the soul of her, the spirit of her, because she'd been taken from the kist. She was being investigated by archaeologists, and we needed to bring her home, actually. And what they discovered with their archaeology was wonderful. I mean, wonderful revelations about how loved she was, the items that had been made to put in with her after her bones had been burned, this beautiful bundle. The amber that you mentioned was especially magical, I think, because when they really looked at it, they realized it had been very worn. So although she was a woman of about maybe 28 years old, something like this, the amber had been passed down through generations and possibly even from what we would now call Neolithic times, but certainly her old ones had passed that amber down through to her. So she was wearing something that was ancestral to her, which I think is a really magical detail. So around about a few years after she was discovered, I think we were doing this about 2014, we started to create a kist ven here on our land, the same size as the one that she was in, these granite slabs with a stone arch, a processional way leading from our ancestor house out to this in the marshes to where we were building this kist ven. And then we brought together about 400 people onto the land for a festival. And the festival was all about bringing her home and honouring her. And we did 3 days and nights of ceremony. During the day, we made things with all the ingredients that she had had in her bone bundle. So we used lime bast fibre, we smelted tin. We did all sorts of things that were resonant with what had been found. And we made a symbolic bone bundle with wild horse bones that were found. Actually, I found them very close to where she had her kiss. It was on the route up over the North Moor there. This horse had had this wild winter death, and these bones were gathered up to be symbolic for her. And that's what's in the kist now. So the first night we had a procession led by the brothers, by the men, and they led the procession with flutes. And they did this initial opening of the ceremony. And the second night it was led by the women, and it was all done with drums. And we had drums and dancers in the marshes and fire, and we lit a pyre. Or we did this big, quite impassioned lamenting ceremony. And then the last night we actually carried the bundle down for the final closing of the capstone. And that was prayerful, and that was a lullaby, really, for her. So since then, we have occasionally lifted the capstone, slid it to one side so that we could have a new set of offerings of the prayer there. Mostly it stays intact, but there's little gaps around the edges where people can put their offerings. And this is what happens. People come there to honour not just her, but the whole weave of ancestor people, especially actually the women. The ancestor women are honoured very specifically in this place. And we do a lot of vigils at night with the moon, making ceremony around this kist ven. So although she hasn't returned in her physical form to Dartmoor, we felt that during this ceremony process, we were able to anchor her soul and everything that she represents in terms of the ancestral community at that point of time. We've been able to get that into the land here so people could come and connect with it in that way.
This is such beautiful work, remembering the ceremonies and the sacred ways of the ancestors and allowing that to come through us in new ways, new but old ways, so that we can really honour the ancestors in the ways that, you know, they want to be honoured. That's what your ceremony speaks of to me, is that ancient remembering of how to be in ceremony and how to be in ritual with the ancestors and how to be reverent of the past and also very empowered in the present moment to our own place in lineage and the ways in which we are being called to remember these ceremonies and these ancient ways. And I know that Dartmoor is such an important place for you. You know, it's the place where you live, but it's so much more than that. And I know that you host a lot of workshops and experiences on your farmstead. You just gave us a beautiful example where you've built a roundhouse in the Neolithic style, I believe, and you also have the kist. So I would love to hear a bit more about the work that you do in the roundhouse and on the land with women and the importance of reviving the ancestral ways of women.
Yes, so building the roundhouse nearly 25 years ago has been key to the work here because it created the ancestor hearth, and that pinned everything into this piece of land. It enabled us then to really open out the land to people to come to make ceremony and to join in the circles and in the workshop that we've been offering here. But for the women especially, it's been a very profound unfurling of a journey. And some women have been coming here for all of this time, for nearly 30 years, keeping their connection strong to this hearth. And during this time, we've opened up to thousands of people have come through. You know, we're very private as well. It's not open all the time. At winter time, we close everything down so we can hibernate. But in the summer, everything has got more of a flow. And over the time, we've had many people come to journey. The women who come in so many different ways, but it all connects into a big weave of work. So it's as if we have waves of work that gradually deepen us into the heart of the roundhouse and extend out into the land. So over time, as the ceremonies have evolved, so has the ritual landscape all around the roundhouse. So there are shrines and there's Neolithic style trackway through the marshes, and there's of course the Kist Fen, and there's other protection shrines created everywhere, and some of them are permanent and some of them are just there for a season or a few seasons. It just depends on how the flow of the prayer is going, and some of them are new. We've just this winter planted a new ceremonial woodland area, which we're calling the Freedom Drum, and that ties in. It's an avenue that comes from the Kist back around to the roundhouse. So it's a slow evolving, and we never make a plan with how these things are going to go. What happens is women tend to start walking a prayer, and then over a year or 2 years, the prayer becomes very clear, and then we create the shrine that goes to meet the prayer that's been there. So it has been a key ingredient really of the work here, this ancestor hearth. And whenever the fire is lit, it feels as if we are awakening strands of memory that go out from that fireplace up onto the hills into all of the ancestral memory in the Bronze Age and Neolithic settlements all around us and beyond into all our landscapes. But we always feel it is as if in that moment of lighting the fire, the ancestor mothers are catching that and turning their footsteps towards the roundhouse. And over again, we have this sensation of arrival around our circle of these layers of ancestor women coming in to be our backs while we're creating our work. So that's been the way it has been here for a long time. And I love the depth of it, but I also love the constant surprise of it. And the change of it, it's always evolving and changing and shifting, so it keeps me on my toes as well.
I think that speaks so deeply to the true listening and the depth of the prayers coming through in that very natural, organic, intuitive way that isn't planned and is truly from the spirit, from the heart. And following some of these threads, how has living in rhythm with the land where you are on Dartmoor and the shrines that you create and the seasons, how have these things helped you to understand the ancient ancestors and also proto-Celtic in deep ways?
So Dartmoor has been everything really that has enabled all of this to happen. I came to Dartmoor as a young woman, as I think I mentioned earlier, but it took me a while to get myself back here after life journeys. But I vowed myself to her when I was very young. I knew I would return. I just wasn't sure in what form that would be or what I would have to have learned and gathered up into my life before I could get here. But I did get back here when I was in my early 30s, and I've been here ever since, and I will stay here till the end. So Dartmoor is like the river that runs beneath my soul dream. And she has given me the foundation on which to understand and create and share and grow my work. But an important part of that has been on our small hill farm, which is a very traditional hill farm, and the farm is about 1,000 years old. Our farmhouse is very ancient. It's a very humble little Dartmoor hill farm with a lot of bog and marsh and, you know, rivers everywhere. But the point of the physicality of it, that what it requires of us physically to look after it and tend it, is a beautiful addition to the dreaming. We need to be working with it all the time, with the seasons and with the weather, and tending the wild pony herd and looking after everything on the land, looking after the roundhouse, working with hay, the organic hay crops. You know, the physicality of tending has been very, very important, because it's like a commitment and a dedication to the ancient way of working a piece of land. And all of that has also been intuitive. We've kind of cut our own furrows with it, really. We just work it out, see what this piece of land is needing of us. But the physical work is constant, and I love that. It makes it feel that it has an integrity, and it's very real. There's a real muscle ache at the end of the day, and that then enables the dreams to be more embedded, I think, because there's a balance. We have to kind of do both.
That balance feels so integrous and true to the ways in which our ancestors would have lived. You know, our ancestors worked so hard. They worked the land so intensely. And so there is that physicality and the action and the prayer and action with the land, as well as the dreaming and the more inner way of working with the ancestors. And so that balance is really beautiful, and I deeply honor it.
And also, I feel that Dartmoor is a memory archive, so that when you walk on the moor, when I go out on the open moor, that I sing constantly. I'm hearing songs in the landscape. Every piece of granite rock seems to be vibrating with ancient memory. And it's just a question of us going out there to gather it and to feel it and to meet it. I sometimes, well, often hear people saying that they feel we lost our indigenous root in this land, that we have to look to other cultures to find the pieces that can make up what we no longer have, what got forgotten or destroyed. And I just don't feel that is the truth. I think it's that we don't look, we don't listen. And if you just go into a piece of wild land here, and Dartmoor is a perfect place to do this, and listen and watch and wait and feel, it's there in such profusion to be remembered. It's all being held within the archive of the land, so there's a lot of freedom in that remembering as well. And it feels that the whole place is a wild sanctuary for our souls, which is why it's so beautiful when people come to share it.
I feel that those words are just expanding in me, what you just shared, and that deeper truth that to really be in the remembering of the ancestral ways is to listen and to be present and to be with the land, and that can never be broken or forgotten. It can be buried and put aside, but never truly forgotten. So that really awoke and stirred something very deep in me. So thank you. And I'd just like to ask if there's anything else you would like to share with us to complete this beautiful conversation that we've had.
Thank you. Yes. So I'm sitting in my studio, and I'm surrounded by 14 new paintings, which I've been working on all winter. These are larger than life-size women, and they're part of this new body of work called the Muxno Wali, which means in Proto-Celtic the marsh women or the marsh wolves. And they're part of this new body of work, which encompasses songs and a book. So there's a lot going on in the studio at the moment. But what I am doing with the Proto-Celtic language, they're named, all of them, with a Proto-Celtic word, but they are far more ancient in their manifestation. They're primordial women. But the Bronze Age language is forming a bridge through which I can reach across to them even though they are actually much older than the language words I'm using to describe them. So it's a bit complicated to explain what that is, but I would like to just share the women's names. So I'll just share those with you as a final piece, and then if you would like me to sing, I could end with a song as well. So these are the 14 names. Kuksa, Bago, Salik, Rinja, Tanta, Yoini, Lugra, Kolo, Selga, Sera, Kuruko, Tawato, Maini, Webru. So I'm going to sing you this song called The Wounds of Winter. It translates like this. To the highlands from the valleys, we go on paths trodden by deer. This is our secret home. It's all we've known, these mountains where our mothers still stand. This amber and copper honour our mother's land. This whetstone and grinding rock honour our mother's land. This warm vessel of honey honours our mother's land on the wild and free mountains where our mothers still stand. These blessings of summer, this bellowing of stags, these wounds of winter honour our mother's land on the wild and free mountains where our mothers still stand. Chari briganu glenos nisere man talo elanti anne que quella runa kelo qua kuna tecnato sondo brignano. Sondo prignano kajal banani an webro omzo kajal banani ochlina broan kajal banani tapaka krai kro sondo prigan risho Atibinano Chari priganu glenos Nisere man talo elanti Anne que quella runa kelo Quacuna tecnato Sondo prignano, sondo prignano. Kajal banani an moitis amin. Kajal banani balko sido prim. Kajal banani krekto gijamo. Sondo prigan rijo atipinano. So, if you are interested in finding out about my work a bit more, this year I have a new album, The Creel and the Croc and the Cauldron. A new book, which is Book of Hag, Volume 2. It's called Peat, P-E-A-T. And the new paintings that I've mentioned. And as they are published over the year to come, and all the work that I've done so far, including the Bone Bundle, you can find on our Seventh Wave Music website. That's seventhwavemusic.co.uk. And I also teach an online program called The Weaver's Trail, and there's monthly live teaching, and it's many women all around the world are walking this Weaver's Trail with me. And if you want to dip in and have a look at that and see what that is all about, it's based around the Bone Bundle that we've been talking about, but also my work, The Weaver's Oracle. You can find that on the other website, which is thebraidedriver.co.uk. So, yeah, come and meet me on either of those places. It would be lovely to connect.
Deep gratitude, Carolyn, for all of your beautiful creations, your work the medicine that you share with the world. You are a true elder of these ancestral ways, and I honor you so deeply in that. And I'd like to thank and honor the ancestors that we lovingly called into this space. And for those of you who are listening, I invite you just to take a few deep breaths, really integrating the wisdoms that you've received through Carolyn's transmission and this conversation, and really holding this prayer of us around the fire as we remember, as we walk this path of remembrance. So thank you to the ancestors. Thank you to the spirit of the fire. Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you all. You've been listening to Dreaming the Ancestors with Tara Brading. My passion is connecting women to the wisdom of their ancestors, specializing in ancestral feminine wisdom from Ireland and England. If you feel called to connect with your Irish ancestry in an embodied, spiritual, feminine way, I lovingly invite you to sign up for my free reclamation journey, which includes a 90-minute video to connect with your Irish ancestry and ancient heritage. And if you hear the call to connect with your English ancestry, I have a 3-hour introductory workshop called Women of the Wells. You can find these offerings at tara-wild.com/get-started. To spell that out, that's tara-wild.com/get-started.